Jesus, God. We're getting to a minute of that. I was like, you're going to stop this soon, right?
I just did.
Thank you.
Now I'm going to take this microphone.
Yes.
And I'm going to hand it to our special guest.
Yes.
Robert Abley.
Right. Of the Los Angeles Times.
Of the Los Angeles Times. And then I'm going to explain why I chose that beautiful music. Because I know you're wondering.
Yes.
I know you're super wondering.
Yes, yes. It was. If anybody didn't know, it was Dave's week to pick the music. If that wasn't an obvious tip-off,
I could have guessed that was Dave's choice.
Yeah. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you very much.
And I'm on. No, you. Okay. Here's what's going to happen.
What?
You're going to use your mic like you use your mic.
Uh huh.
And when I need to talk into your mic, I will get close to it.
You should really be facing it though. That's why.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it does.
We're going to have to keep moving it back and forth like this if we don't. It was such a low-rent operation here.
I think I'd rather see you guys get really, really close. Your faces get
like as my head on your shoulder.
Like your
Dreamland
or a 60s folk duo or something.
I chose the music this week for a podcast, a thematic reason.
Uh-huh.
The name of that band was Live Skull, mm-hmm. One of the great bands of the 80s.
Wasn't that the metal band that was all 8-year-old kids?
No, that was Old Skull.
Oh, sorry.
Old Skull was the little kids.
Old Skull?
Yeah.
And Live Skull?
Live Skull was New York contemporaries of Sonic Youth, sort of noisy, sludgy sounding.
So Sonic Youth, basically.
Stuff. No.
Oh.
Anyway, the song is called I Was Wrong. I've been scolded for my DVD choice of last week because it's out of print. I didn't realize this until after the show.
You sent millions of people.
I sent
searching for.
I sent twos of people out in hunt of Chiming Lang's Vive L'Amour.
The interwebs went down everywhere.
It is available for sale on eBay.
It caused the blackout in New Orleans.
Also, I was wrong in describing what it was about.
Wow. That's a twofer.
My defense is that it's been about 15 years since I've seen it, or something like that, and I forgot... that
major plot details.
Yeah, major plot details. Here's the thing, and I will, in my defense, I will say that I often forget plot details of almost every film I see, and what I am always left with is how I felt and what I felt the film was sort of really about. So, if you ask me what Vive L'Amour is about, I will tell you that it's about loneliness, mm-hmm. and that is in fact what it is about.
So you'll tell us, but what, the fact that's about that, in your heart,
but yes, in my extremely noisy live skull heart,
your heart is like the fantasy sequences in The Lovely Bones.
Well, no, wait, but isn't that
was the land of Dairy Queen though?
But isn't
in The Lovely Bones when she goes to heaven? It's the land of Dairy Queen.
The land of Dairy Queen. If Dairy Queen took an ad out in Seventeen magazine,
something like that.
But isn't that something that allows us to go back to movies? I mean, like our brain, I think, sometimes consciously lets us forget things so that we can watch favorite movies again and enjoy them again and be surprised by them again.
I always think of The Last of Sheila as a movie I enjoy because I don't always remember all the details.
It's so convoluted.
Yeah.
Yes.
So anyway, go to eBay and get yourself a copy of Viva La Mort. They have cheap VHS copies if you still happen to have a video cassette recorder in your house.
I was just watching a Match Game 75, and the contestant was saying that y'all need to have an evening version so that those of us who work during the day can watch the show.
And then they got back to PM.
That's true. No,
somebody's dream came true.
I was just thinking, okay, so not only did the Match Game PM not yet exist, but neither did the VCR, or at least not in general use.
Not in big use, yeah.
No. So this is an interesting...
So explain Robert Abele better than I just did.
Robert Abele writes for the Los Angeles Times. He is the author of the recent... What is your book called? I'm sorry, I forgot.
Twilight, the Complete Film Archive.
Yes. So Robert did not go into this project necessarily as a twihard, but he nonetheless bravely researched the heck out of it, saw all the movies, talked to all the people. If you are remotely inclined towards that series of films or know someone who is, it's a book that you must have. Robert is also one of my oldest friends in the world. We met in 1990.
It was 90,
yeah. Because I was my first year at the Film Festival.
And I had just started working at the Dallas Times Herald,
right,
where you had been before.
Where I had been before, yeah. So actually the first time that I moved to Los Angeles in 1992 was with heterosexual but love Sondheim Robert Abele. And we shared an apartment for 2 years.
Also, you're in my book.
That's right.
He is Hedder Robert. and Dave and I were in his wedding to the lovely Margie Rockland, who actually listens to this show.
So. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I'm the only person who's been to all the weddings. All your weddings.
No. Kim did not come to the tar pits.
San Francisco.
They came to San Francisco. They drove up.
Oh, that's right. You were there. There was photographic evidence of that.
Robert has attended all the weddings.
I'm a dummy.
I've been to all the Alonzo and Dave weddings.
Eventually, one of them is going to stick.
and if Robert attends one more wedding, he gets a free sub sandwich. So.
Thank you. I've got my card punched.
It's very exciting. So, it is still February, but the movies are getting a little better. A little bit. Well, one movie was good this week, so that's better.
What was the good one this week?
Side Effects.
Side Effects.
Which is a very tough movie to talk about because the pleasure of it is in knowing as little as possible.
Yeah.
So we don't want to give the goods away.
It is constructed of surprise.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it I think there's a way to talk about it.
We can talk about the first half of the first act. The setup is that... Channing Tatum.
Did either of you have any Oblixa? I could use
it. is your depression following you around like an overcoat?
Yes, can we just say like right off the bat, this movie has the most amazing parody commercial of one of those antidepressant
commercials. There's a whole website for it, actually.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Go to Google, look up Oblixa, A-B-L-I-X-A. That is the fake drug from this movie, and they have a whole fake internet ad campaign for it. So Rooney Mara is a woman who has been dealing with the fact that her husband Channing Tatum has been in prison for years for insider trading, and he's about to get out, but because of getting caught for insider trading, you know, their awesome life in Greenwich, Connecticut is no more, and so now she's been living in New York and trying to, you know, hold it all together. He's getting out of jail, and he's got plans for, you know, new business ventures, but she is clearly depressed, and once he gets home, things get even worse, and she attempts suicide by driving her car into a wall. The police want to put her under psychiatric observation, but she makes a deal with the physician on duty, who is played by Jude Law, that she will start going to therapy, you know, on a regular basis with him if he'll let her go that day. So they start going to therapy. He tries her out on several medications, and they don't seem to be working out. And then they try Oblixa, which he has been paid by the company to sort of try out on his patients and you know, do clinical studies. And then things get crazy, and we won't talk about it.
Take Back Tomorrow.
Dave just posted the link to the Oblixa website on our page on Facebook.
I think one thing we can say about is that, you know, one of the things they find out is that it has this side effect of people, you know, sleepwalking, which you know is tight. You know, Ambien had that issue, so sure. it will feel relevant to people when they see it.
And what was the joke on 30 Rock? May cause sexual nightmares and sleep crimes.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's a movie that at the beginning you think is a I don't know, say standard, but I mean a solid issue oriented movie about drugs, and I think the way Soderbergh shoots Rooney Mara when she's going through her depressive moments are some of the best photographic kind of like a dramatic use of somebody who's depressed I've seen.
Well, yeah, I mean, it definitely kind of it MacGuffins you in a lot of different ways where you think it's going to be this sort of medical thing, or it's going to be, you know, Dave was pointing out that it sort of does that Magic Mike thing where, oh, you think this is just going to be a movie about, you know, the economy and what it's doing to people and how their lives are responding to it.
It really is like the movie itself is kind of like one of those ads, because, you know, those ads are like, you know, your people are on, you know, on horseback and walking through fields and like with their loved ones, and then the you know, they're talking about how much better your life can be, and then all of a sudden this little thread of all these weird things that could happen starts entering into the ad, all the side effects,
right?
And it adds this weird undertone to the ad, and that's what this movie is. It is one thing,
odds
and then
are,
it is something else.
Odds are this drug will put you on horseback, but it might give you homicidal thoughts.
Yes.
Watching Rooney Mara in this, because the only thing I had seen her in was Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
No, you saw Social Network.
That's right.
Oh, well, okay, that's true. But
no, but I mean, that's important because she's amazing in that first scene.
No, absolutely. She's great, but she's also, she's in and out of there quickly. I think about her as Elizabeth Sander. So the whole time I was watching her in this film, it's sort of like when you see those pictures of Boris Karloff out of the Frankenstein makeup. And you start sort of just mentally adding it and figuring out, okay, that's where his face is. Like, I was sort of putting eyeliner on her in my mind and turning her into, you know.
She's got a very kind of like malleable face. It seems to, with very little work, and it can look totally different the way you shoot it. The angles of her face are really interesting.
Now, and her sister is Kate Mara, who was in Brokeback Mountain. Was she in that?
And she's in House of Cards.
Oh, she doesn't have scars. Yes. Oh, cool. And was she in that Channing Tatum movie, The 10 Years, that you saw?
I can't remember.
Because
there's a whole gang of people.
Yeah, I was thinking she was part of that ensemble, and maybe that was the connection between them. Who knows? But whatever. No big deal.
No, Fincher's been giving the Mara gals mad props.
So, yeah. Anyway, side effects. It's really entertaining, and you should run out and see it before anybody ruins it for you.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting, it's an interesting take on this notion that we take these drugs to make, to supposedly be a version of ourselves that's the best.
Right.
And it kind of flips that on its head.
Definitely, yeah. And you know, I think I Soderbergh doesn't really get credit for this kind of thing, but I think he is the best director of movie stars we have right now in terms of putting them through their paces. Like Jude Law, some of the best work I've seen him do in ages. Catherine Zeta-Jones, who plays Rooney Mara's previous therapist, also really exciting and unpredictable.
And he frankly, not totally, because I thought he was really good in The Vow, but I mean, like he made me see why Channing Tatum actually is a movie star.
He is the Channing Tatum whisperer, although I did like 21 Jump Street a lot, too.
That is true. Yeah, actually, I don't know why. I was about to say that. I thought, no, I can think of other things where I think he's charming and the camera loves him. And
Step Up to the Streets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
he just had a cameo in that, but it was a very wiggly one.
Yeah. No, but how does this feel to you guys as like a potential final Steven Soderbergh movie?
You know, I'll believe that when I see it.
Like, oh no, I believe I see it too. But if
Ingmar Bergman kept saying he was making his last movie, you know, over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, if it is his last one, I'd say it's, you know, it's not like he's going out on Bubble, you know, I mean, he's
Full Frontal.
Right. Yeah. I think this is a nice capper for that. And we've still got the Liberace. We've
still got the Liberace
movie,
which I really cannot wait for. Oh,
so excited.
That promises to be joy.
Delicious.
Gay noise that you just made there. Oh, oh.
Please, it's a Liberace TV movie.
I just wouldn't
deserves a gay noise.
Anybody play Paul Linden is what I want to know. That would
Yeah.
Well,
is anyone going to do that?
I would hope. There was this actor whose name I forget now, but was doing like a one-man show of Paul Lynde.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it at Mismatch, too. He's very good. So, you know, that could be his niche. In the not-so-good category opening this week, and of course, winning the weekend, Identity Thief.
I think it's funny that you just said not-so-good.
Okay, really super wretched.
Pukey barfersons.
Yeah. Well, but this is where I would disagree with you guys.
Start disagreeing.
I recognize that Identity Thief as a shell is a bad movie, but I'm sorry. Everything Melissa McCarthy did, I thoroughly enjoyed watching. So it's one of those movies that yes, it you kind of like write it off as that thing that somebody makes when they want to jump on a train that's going, it's going to take them to a new level of stardom.
Yes.
But she ran with it. I think I laughed at many things she did. And then on top of that, Jason Bateman, I laugh at things he does. He didn't have as good of a role, but I mean, as a Melissa McCarthy vehicle, if you like Melissa McCarthy.
I love her. I'm going to
let you take this one.
I'm going to 30% agree with you on this. Only because of her. Only because of her.
Yeah,
I am a huge fan.
She's the only reason
of hers.
Yeah,
you know, since Gilmore Girls, right. And we've seen her do stuff with the Groundlings here on stage, and I can't breathe as I'm laughing so much.
Yeah,
when,
I mean,
when she's doing when yeah. she's doing her thing,
I can.
You know, I saw her do the motivational speaker that sort of became the character that's in Bridesmaids,
right?
She's fantastic.
Yeah, she is. And this movie, I want to say that I think this movie gives her many, many ways to show the different ways that she's funny. I mean, she is a superb physical comedian. She is great at faces, and she's great verbally. And she can play different characters, and she has to play different characters based on this role she has of somebody who, you know,
she is the one piece of non-rotten fruit in this garbage heap.
Absolutely.
However, it is a garbage heap, and she sits on top of it and tries to make it not stink.
Yeah, I wouldn't even qualify the garbage heap part. It's at least not one of those garbage heap movies where I just think the movie's pretty kind of like dull and not funny when it's but it's not. It wasn't like patently offensive. I kind of went in thinking it was going to be a gross out movie, a gross out comedy with just unconscionably like offensive jokes, and it really was just more like a kind of a mess of a movie that thank God had she was in.
Here's the thing. A, I was bored out of my mind. Like, it was one of those movies that I thought was never going to end.
Well, I mean, for the first, like, until she's a major part of the movie, it is really boring.
And while I agree with you that she is blameless in this, and I think she does give it her all and provides what few moments of life that it has, I think the movie goes out of its way to kneecap her by making her into this sobby mess periodically and all boo-hooey and self-pitying about her life and blah, blah, blah. If that had been a role played by Will Ferrell or Jim Carrey or Owen Wilson or Zach Galifianakis, they would have been this sort of unhinged criminal mastermind goon weirdo with maybe one moment toward the end where they sort of let their guard down and they show their vulnerability and blah, blah, blah. No, 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 no. She has every 20 minutes or so they make her cry and they make her, and it gets into that weird sappy area and of a movie that a lot of people cited that this was ripping off, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Like, for me, that movie goes south every time John Candy gets one of those, well, my wife likes me moments. I know people love that movie, but that stuff just killed it for me, and it kills it this one for me, too.
I don't agree with that in that respect here because I always feel like when she's crying, you always think there's the possibility that that's part of the character is just
if it were that would be great. If she were using that as part of the con, that would be awesome. But it's not.
But to me, she always comes off like a strong character. I mean, who can take care of herself, and I think that's the key thing to the character is that you never looked at her as victimized at all. I mean, you don't think you looked at John Candy, and I mean, I kind of like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, but you never looked at John Candy as somebody who could take care of himself.
Yeah.
But Melissa McCarthy, I mean, like, they give her that gag where she can punch somebody in the throat and disable them.
They do it over and over again. I know, but
that actually was funny. It was actually funny.
It was funny once or twice.
And they made her character somebody who could take care of herself. I think that is a step forward for women, you know, in comedies like that.
I laughed, I'd say, about half a dozen times. And it was always because of her.
Right.
And there were those moments when she did well up with tears, where you thought, okay, she's putting them on right now. But I knew I was in trouble when it started, when she goes to the bar and buys everyone drinks and swings from the chandelier and you know, does all that stuff. And the bartender says, people like you don't have friends. And she got... her eyes welled up. And I thought, oh, God, no, please don't do this to me. Don't make her.
Don't do this to her.
Well, movie, please don't do this to me. Yes. Also, secondarily, filmmakers, stop, you know, doing this to her. But I don't want this person to be pathetic. I want them to be triumphant. I want Bugs Bunny always to win. I want the Three Stooges always to run out of the room thinking that they have created success.
Yeah,
and that's what I was looking for in her.
I agree, but I never thought of her as pathetic because she is so active and so like...
Okay, but the scene where she goes to the car where she could have ditched Jason Bateman, but then he gets a phone call from his kids and she sees their picture on phone and wells up. It's like, oh, come on.
Here's how I saw those scenes, basically. I saw those scenes. Yeah, they were all incredibly formulaic, and I'm not going to like excuse them as things that exist in a screenplay before it's cast.
Right.
But she's so good, I think she sells almost everything in that movie. I see your point. I just never had a problem. I mean, it's kind of like when you see, when I see Will Ferrell in a movie that isn't good, but he's always fun to watch. My problem with the movie is that it so made no sense as a story. I mean, yeah.
Why are those two thugs after her? Why does that guy in jail care about
that?
Her?
They just should have gotten rid of anything relating to a plot and just made it a pure personality driven, crazy comedy like a movie like Talladega Nights or Anchorman, where you just frankly, you know, it doesn't matter what the story is. They're just like we think the scene is so weird and crazy funny that we're going to put it in the movie anyway.
Right, but the problem with that is sometimes you wind up with the watch,
or you wind up with look, Hollywood is littered with that first movie that comes out after somebody hits it big, and it's the wrong vehicle.
Right.
And Identity Thief is a poor vehicle, but she...
But now she can open a movie. Bam.
Oh, my God. No, and that will be good for her going forward. And look, didn't they just announce that she's now like starring in something that she wrote and her husband's going to direct? So she's going to take even more control over things.
No. I definitely, because she's part of the you know, Apatow gang, I want her to sort of be nurtured under that bubble where
But I mean, why does she have to be nurtured by Judd Apatow?
I'm not saying that she's not capable of her own stuff. I'm just saying that I want him to be her like godfather, basically, where she can be,
I'm kind of done with no, I'm not done. I just like, you know, we need more. I think
he's good about nurturing other people's talents. You know, right. I mean, like he cast Kristen Wiig in Bridesmaids after that moment that she had in 40-Year-Old Virgin or in Knocked Up. You know, you look at like the opportunities he's given to people
of course,
Jason Segel. So I'm not saying I want him to take over her career. I'm just saying I want him to be the wall between her and stupid studios that want to put her in movies like this one. Should we talk about Rex Reed for a moment?
Yeah, and the Rex Reed thing is interesting because, you know, yeah, it's incredibly... It's so funny because, like, if you are a thoughtful critic, you find a way to talk about somebody's size in a way that's interesting and that points to what the things that they're good at. Like, for example, when I watch Melissa McCarthy on screen, I think about this amazing group of, like, of of larger comedians over the years that have this incredible physical agility that always seems to be so, almost like dancer-like and surprising, sure, like Fatty Arbuckle,
Chris Farley,
and she is clearly in that. I mean, she has amazing control of her body, and it's just so sad when someone like Rex Reed only goes to that place.
One of the, it's reprehensible that he would go after her in that way.
He called her a hippo and tractor-sized.
Yeah, but what I find kind of fascinating in all this is that he's been bad mouthing Seth Rogen for being fat for years.
Yeah, whereas if you saw Seth Rogen in person, you realize he's basically normal size.
Yeah, the thing is, no one said boo about it. It was only when he said it about a woman, and now suddenly everybody's like, "Oh my God, Rex Reed, you're the worst person on earth." It's like, he's been the worst person on earth for a while now.
Here's the thing:
you just weren't looking.
Right.
Fat guys. You can bag on a fat dude and it doesn't matter because it bounces off. Fat guys
literally.
Fat guys get away with being fat. Are you persecuted for being fat? I'm not. Does anyone shriek at you if you go to the beach and take off your shirt at a beach or whatever? No one cares. Guys get away with having any kind of body they want.
Are we counting visits home?
We are not counting your family. We are not counting your family.
No, you're right. Fat women do get
fat
a much
women
harder deal.
Have it harder. There's
even worse than fat gays.
By way of anecdote, one time we went to visit Alonzo's sister and her mother-in-law, her late mother-in-law, was there, and she immediately got on Alonzo for being fat, and was like, "Hello, great to see you after all this time. Wow, you sure are fat now."
Nice.
And then she said, "I just want to know, where does it end?"
Wow.
Yeah.
Where does it
end? And to this day, I feel like I'm the hero of your life because I jumped in immediately and I said, "It doesn't." I said, "We're taking this all the way. We want to be carried out on a flatbed truck by Richard Simmons."
Richard Simmons is going to come take the front off of our house.
And she shut up and did not talk to me for the rest of the trip. It was great.
I thought mother-in-laws were supposed to feed and feed and feed and like think that you never looked fat enough. I mean,
maybe your own mother-in-law. This was my sister's mother-in-law. So I didn't that level of affection didn't carry over.
It was a wonderful moment.
Yes. Yeah. No, you're right. Fat women do bear more of a brunt of societal disapproval and that kind
much
of thing.
More.
Yeah. No.
It's absolutely. Night and day. It's night and day. I feel no other
and
than
yet,
other than from. Rex Reed, who clearly has a problem with all fat people.
Right.
Other than that, like I don't feel any sort of persecution or disapproval.
It has been noted by some YouTube commenters, believe it or not.
Oh, well, really?
That, now get ready for this. Turns out.
Some YouTube commenters.
Turns out I'm fat.
Also gay.
And I'm gay. Which now I know, thanks to YouTube commenters.
Which is first? Are you gay first and then fat, or fat and then gay?
I'm gat and fey. I don't know.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah. So Rex Reed, whatever.
Forget the whole history of people like, you know, Reed Wrestler being like, you know, a movie star in the silent era and being large and, you know, it's...
Well, and exactly, and the underlying thing that I get out of so many of his reviews anyway are like... Why isn't Lana Turner making movies anymore?
those would be interesting because she's dead.
Long dead.
The other strange thing about him just as a media personality is that
Margie Rockland, my lovely wife.
Robert's wife gave me an old book that Rex Reed wrote.
Oh, yeah.
Called
right.
People Are Crazy Here.
Right.
Which I actually read as a child out of the Atlanta Public Library.
And it is.
I'm sure you did, Alonzo.
Funny and winning and written by a young man who enjoyed life. And something has happened to this man in the between the ages of 20, whatever, and now that he's in his mid 70s.
Yeah.
Something has happened to this man that's made him sour.
Yeah.
And ugly.
And I've always,
and I don't know what it is, but I wish he would be. I wish he had grown into the guy that he was in that book, that really cool book, and like become more of that instead of letting life beat him down.
So here's my question to you too, yeah. Dave Alonzo. What are you going to do to ensure that you don't become Rex Reed?
Keep eating.
I think we keep each other in check on that one. I mean, the thing is, I, you know, and this is this, you know, Dave and I read each other's stuff and edit each other. One of the things that Dave's been really good about calling me out on is if I occasionally do make an observation.
Fuddy-duddyism.
No, that's what I'm talking about.
Well, if I will, there is that thing.
Shut up. If I occasionally make an observation about an actress's appearance, you know, he is very. He makes sure that I'm doing it for a reason, that I'm talking about a certain actress whose face no longer moves. Yeah,
right, exactly. You know? I mean, you can't not do that.
Yeah,
I mean,
because that's relevant to the performance.
If you're watching a period piece and somebody doesn't look right because they clearly had all this work done, right. that affects the movie. Yes. Yeah.
Like, yeah. I remember you talking about a movie where somebody had a 1990s head in a 1950s.
It was Renee Zellweger.
Well, I wasn't going to say
playing. No, we talked about
George Hamilton's mother.
Yeah. Renee Zellweger playing George Hamilton's mother in the movie whose name I cannot remember right now, but it was set in the 50s, and her face is from the nows, and that was disconcerting. Like, it made it impossible to. It made it completely distracting. You know, it was a distraction, you know, and it made me unable to pay attention to anything else. Right. That's a thing. In that context, yes, you talk about the body of the person.
Yeah. But only if it, you know.
Yeah, but like in a comedy where
where she's clearly owning it and using it and right. using it as part of her physicality.
She's using being fat in every scene where she runs, and everyone can outrun her just by walking.
Yeah.
Like, that's funny. And that's because that's a choice she made.
Exactly.
You know, so it's
her surprise that it's funny.
Right.
What are you, Kenyan? Yes. Also opening this week in limited release, but also available on demand, is A Glimpse into the Mind of Charles Swan III, a new film written and directed by Roman Coppola, who is currently up for an Oscar for co-writing Moonrise Kingdom. It's his second movie after 2001's CQ, and it stars Charlie Sheen, set in the 1970s. It's about a graphic designer who is having a midlife crisis.
Yeah.
I didn't see this movie, but it looks like a movie that I probably know what it is.
Probably,
you know what it is.
Yeah. It is very much an exercise in style. Like, if you saw CQ,
right.
What that movie does for, like, Danger Diabolik and Barbarella, this movie does for Bob Fosse and for that whole sort of, that early to mid-70s love of 30s and 40s graphics and cars and outfits, you know, when women were...
Art Deco was really big in...
Art Deco, yeah. Women were doing like the kind of the cloche and the headscarves, sure. And stuff and the big cars and, you know, just like every sort of movie theater animation we ever saw as a kid about the snack bar where it was done in that sort of post-Peter Max but animated 1930s neon kind of thing. That's what this movie is all about, and that's kind of all it has to offer, really, is the look and the...
But what's the Charlie Sheen part? What's that like?
Well,
he's good, actually. I will give him credit for bothering to give a performance. It's not a very deep character, so there's not a lot for him to plumb in it, but I think he's fine.
He plays his now cocaine self, and he plays... the 70s version of himself. He plays his Quaalude self as well. and he's got, you know, this Prousty kind of last name in the film.
Oh, and I didn't think about that.
I'm smart at things.
I've read more of Swan's Way than you have.
We had a competition. We had a contest to see who could get further into Swan's Way. We each had a copy. And for a while I was winning, but then I got bogged down and
I think Swan's Way wins the award for
and I put it down as well.
Book that is on most night tables without actually getting rid of it.
Yeah, it's a challenge.
But the... the most interesting thing about this film for me is that he plays a man who's out of control. And the women in his life are all, to one degree or another, trying to, you know, corral him back into control. Or else they are his exes and they don't want anything to do with him. And he's trying to get back with them.
Well, it sounds very All That Jazz.
It's very All That Jazz, yeah.
And yeah, it's...
But they even throw in a Lenny moment out of nowhere where, like, the character played by Jason Schwartzman is a singing star. Like, he's a rock singer. But suddenly there's a scene where he's doing stand-up comedy so they can shoot it like the scene in Lenny with the, you know, the spotlight and the thing only in color. I don't know.
And, you know, there are all these fantasy sequences that I said it reminded me of. You know, that Anthony Newley movie, Can Hieronymus Merkin Ever Forget Mercy Hump and Find True Happiness?
Okay.
It's, but the big takeaway for me was, aside from the fact that all of his redemption is very free and easy, like he doesn't have to work for
it. No, it's like that.
It's just sort of handed to him. It makes me wonder about Charlie Sheen himself, you know, like, if we could recontextualize the actual Charlie Sheen and put him back in the 70s, would we be so up in arms about his behavior? I think in an era that is, you know, remembered for its excess, he would just be one of the regular dudes
Polanski would have been at his house.
Yeah, exactly.
But, I mean, yeah, basically if what had happened to Charlie Sheen, if he were like a movie star as opposed to a sitcom TV star in prime time on a show watched by, you know, Midwestern families. Yeah. I mean, that's why it became what it was, because that was, you know, that was the vehicle that people saw him. I mean, if he had been a A-lister.
Turn your phone off, Dave.
Oh, I'm going to turn my phone off right now.
I thought I was getting like played off. I mean, it was,
I want to thank my,
I mean, if all the drug stuff and craziness had happened because he was while he was making movies, I mean, it just wouldn't have been as big a deal.
Yeah, for sure. We'll give a shout out to Liam Hayes, whose songs are used throughout the film, which were apparently pre-existing songs, but they very much fit the film's 70s vibe, even though he is a current stop that. The audience is listening. He's a contemporary singer-songwriter, and his songs are really good, and they're woven throughout the film. But yeah, it's just, you know, it is such an exercise in style and nothing else, pretty much.
I'll take that over
Identity Thief.
Lots of other, you know, small indie films that or about
not even that
and don't even look good,
but you know, it very much feels like, you know, Coppola with a Rolodex, you know, oh look, it's Bill Murray and it's Colleen Camp and, you know, Jason Schwartzman.
It is kind of fun if you've seen enough of all the Coppola's, you know, products and know the family, you know, marriage history and stuff like that. It's fun to play connect the dots.
Yeah,
like, in a movie like there's Patricia Arquette, and she was married to Nicolas Cage, and he's a Coppola. And then, you know.
And Colleen Camp was in Apocalypse Now, which starred Charlie Sheen's dad and was directed by Roman Coppola's dad. And, you know, yeah, it's... So, yeah, that.
That's fun. That's fun to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Robert saw Yossi, which David and I did not see, which is the sequel to Yossi and Jagger.
So you saw the gay movie this week.
Yeah, the straight guy saw the gay movie.
The straight guy saw the gay movie,
The Israeli gay movie from director Eitan Fox, who did The Bubble and... this
you've seen Yossi and Jagger, right?
Yeah, I've actually never seen Yossi and Jagger.
Okay.
I need to.
All right. Yeah, you should.
And, and he did a great miniseries that we screened at Outfest a couple years ago called Mary Lou that was amazing. It was kind of like it was a jukebox musical.
It's like a musical.
Yeah, it's like a jukebox musical for this Israeli singer I'd never heard of named Svika Peek. But really moving and funny and I was a big fan of it. But
Yossi is that interesting thing where you get like a sequel to an indie. I mean, this doesn't happen very often. But like, you know, Yossi and Jagger was a movie he made over 10 years ago, and it was about two Israeli soldiers in love, and you know, they're closeted. You know, one of them. I don't want to give away too much, but basically, it's not the happiest story in the world.
Jagger is not around for the sequel.
Yeah, so the sequel is called Yossi. I'll let you see. The sequel is called Yossi, and you can, you know, let you figure that out. But I mean, but basically, it follows up with this character 10 years later. He's not in the army anymore. He's a doctor. He's still a kind of he's a lonely kind of enclosed guy who doesn't his colleagues try to draw him out at work to go do things he doesn't want to. He kind of he goes on internet dates that don't end well, and he's just kind of shut off. He's still closeted, and then all of a sudden a woman shows up at work for a checkup who turns out to be Jagger's mom, basically.
Oh wow.
And she doesn't recognize him a little bit, but he recognizes her, and it kind of leads him to this kind of this new place where he opens up a bit more, and then he goes on a trip and comes across a group of young Israeli army guys, and there's the possibility for something new in his life.
Now, if people haven't seen Yossi and Jagger, will this movie work?
It will because you can you can figure things out. It'll be a little bit more oblique, but what's really nice about seeing it, if you've seen the first one, is this lead guy is so great, and he just has this. He seems to have let whatever he was playing in Yossi and Jagger, a guy who. In love, but very compartmentalized about his gayness and his life, how he's let it brew into a very specific kind of 30-something loneliness and sadness, and it's a great kind of quiet performance. Every time he smiles, every time it's just one of those persons that he's so sad that when you see him crack a smile or laugh, it just feels like just the world has opened up. It's like it's a lovely thing to watch. It's really nice.
Oh, cool. Well, I was.
Well, let's watch Yossi and Jagger.
Okay,
yeah, so watch we'll him. I mean, seriously,
I've been dragging my feet.
It's on Netflix. Yossi and Jagger's on Netflix.
I was just looking it up.
Netflix instant? Streaming. Yeah. Okay. And,
I have to have my arm twisted to see pretty much any gay movie.
well, these are blessedly short. Yossi and Jagger's like 74 minutes or something. And Yossi is not even 90. It's
right. Gay movies like Christmas movies now have become work for me. So like I know I don't always rush out to see them, but I should. I was telling these
we
guys,
talk we talk about like what well, it was like.
Yeah, when we showed Yossi at Outfest last summer. And it was kind of a last minute ad because it had just gotten picked up by a distributor and blah blah blah. So we screened it on the last day. And the disc that arrived with the movie did not have English subtitles, and we thought, now what? Luckily, this one guy in the theater who spoke.
Did you not know until it was actually shown?
We did not until the actual show. Yeah, like that. There was.
Did it stop it maybe and like?
I wasn't there for that part, so I don't know what happened. But what wound up happening was this one guy in the audience who spoke fluent Hebrew and English saved the day. He basically went down, sat in the front row. We gave him a microphone, and he live translated the whole thing. And people awesome. Loved it. They were like, "Wow, that's an Outfest moment," And
that would work with that movie because there's not a lot of talking in it. I mean, like somebody
it's not
could,
like a Robert Altman film.
No, someone actually could. Yeah, there's no overlapping. It's that would actually work. That's really funny.
At one point, I remember I got two bottles of water and took him down to the front row, and he was like, "Oh, thanks." But
that reminds me of for some reason that reminds me of when I was. Right out of college and going on that tour around Europe that college kids like to do when they graduate. And I purposely didn't see movies when I was going to various European countries because I knew that if I was going to go see something in the host country's language, it would not be subtitled. And if it was in English, it would be dubbed. And I just thought, why mess with all that? And I got to Paris, though, and I thought, no, Paris is a big international film city, and they will show French movies with English subtitles.
VO.
Yeah, so I thought, great. And then, like this was 89, so, like, the new Jim Jarmusch movie had just opened, and it wasn't going to be in the U.S. for a while. I thought it was really cool that I would get to see Mystery Train, like, before anybody else back in the States. And I'm so excited. I sit down for my first movie in 6 weeks, and, of course, the first story in Mystery Train is in Japanese with French subtitles for the French audience. And I thought, I felt like whatever the word for punked was before punked, that's what I felt. But
where
it ended
is
up,
Alan Funk?
But it ended up,
le punk.
But it ended up being okay because, just like Yossi, there's so little actually spoken in that section with the two Japanese kids that right. And my 2 years of high school conversational French actually got me through that.
Nice.
The
one time, or I can admit it, the one time, but the first time I really tried to brave seeing a movie in Spanish without the subtitles, was I was in Madrid in 1988, and Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown had not opened in the States yet, and it was still showing there. So I went to go see it, packed theater, and I literally sat like with my head at sort of a 45 degree angle, where like my ear was cocked toward the screen because I was just really gonna try and pick, because I would, you know, I speak pretty good Spanish, but in a movie, you know, they speak as quickly as regular Spaniards do, and so you really got to kind of be on it, you know. And apart from not knowing the word for eye drops, I pretty much followed everything. I'm very proud of myself.
That surprised me. I always thought that you actually were so fluent in Spanish that that wouldn't be a problem.
You know, it depends. And obviously, if it's the kind of thing where I've been in Spain for like a month or something, then by that point, I've gotten really adept at it. Sure. I've been bombarded with television and relatives all day. But this was a quick trip, and so it was sort of like, I can mostly get by, I'll turn the Spanish TV channels on here, but every so often they'll either just go at a clip that I can't follow, or they'll get into jargon or slang or something that I don't know, and I'm like, but you know.
It's kind of like our friend Chris, who is a scientist. I can't tell you how good he is at being a scientist, because I don't know anything about that. Like, as far as I know, he's Linus Pauling, you know. And so, like, when Alonzo speaks Spanish, I just assume that he is, you know, Cervantes. Like, there's no there's no gauge, and so I'm just sort of like, look what he can do.
See, I know. Listening to him when we were living together and listening to him talk to his family, I just assumed that he was fluent. I mean, like it was just like
I am arguably fluent by most standards, I guess. But there's fluent, and then there's like, I'm not crossword puzzle fluent. You know, that's a whole other level of like words that you don't ever use, but that if you have read a lot in the language and stuff. Robert's wearing his crossword puzzle sneakers because he's that kind of guy.
That's right.
Was that all the movies this week?
Spiders,
yes. And Ghosts in Connecticut too. You have to tell us about that. You promised last week.
I talked enough about it last week.
No, you said last week that you were going to talk about it this week because you hadn't watched it yet.
Haunting
in Connecticut?
Yeah.
Haunting in Connecticut 2, : Ghosts of Georgia.
I didn't know. I mean, I didn't even know that they'd gotten around to the sequel that quickly.
Yes. So there are these ghosts, and they're in Georgia. And they're the ghosts of slaves. Hmm.
Oh, you did talk about this last week. The Underground Railroad, right?
Yeah.
Right. The Underground Railroad.
Remember?
Right. Okay, yeah. Sorry. Right.
Spiders. Spiders.
Yeah. So it's about these spiders. They come from space.
From space.
And here's the most important thing you need
to know.
Why
didn't it just call Spiders from Space? That would.
I wanted it to be called Space Spiders. This is a film that is distributed by Millennium Entertainment.
Millennium, yes.
Woo!
They are great. And they are great because they gave us Trespass with Nicolas Cage and Nicole Kidman.
Yeah,
they gave us Red Lights.
Yeah, with De Niro.
With Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
They gave us the Kate Hudson with anal cancer drama, A Little Bit of Heaven. Perhaps you saw that one.
You should see it.
No. You should. You should see that film.
It made a lot of 10 worst lists last year.
And this is from a guy named Tibor Takash. And he made Mansquito. Now, Mansquito is the greatest
sci-fi channel movie ever.
The greatest sci-fi channel movie that has ever been made.
When was that on?
About 10 years ago.
Yeah, I kind of remember that when I was doing TV criticism.
So he also made Mega Snake. So now he's making spiders.
So why couldn't he modify the word spider?
No, I don't know.
I mean, he modified mosquito.
Arachnoids.
Yeah, snake. I wish that it...
Like,
there's a lot to love about this movie, but not quite enough. It stars Patrick Muldoon from Melrose Place.
Okay.
And Starship Troopers.
And Krista Campbell.
So he knows who was
spiders. Krista Campbell, who was in a series of erotic confessions episodes. And she was also in Mansquito.
Okay.
So she's part of the repertory.
So I said in my review, I said it's really great when a filmmaker assembles a Mercury Theater style
exactly
a group of actors. So that this is his Joseph Cotten and Agnes Moorehead. And what I like,
or Betty Davis to his Wyler.
The spiders are just sort of like sharktopus level, you know, creations. But it's the people in the film that really give it its joy. It's shot in Bulgaria.
Let's just imagine Patrick Muldoon for a second. You've made one Spiders in Space movie called Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
You're now making another one. Is he thinking, what's going through Patrick Muldoon's mind as he's not working with Paul Verhoeven?
I will tell you.
I'm sure he's probably telling people around Craft Services, well, when I worked with Verhoeven.
Yeah, no, I'm guessing when he made Starship Troopers, he's thinking, I'm in the worst piece of crap ever. This is going to be all. But now he's thinking, I wish I were in
that piece of crap.
I'll tell you what he's thinking. The same thing I was thinking 2 weeks ago when I went to the dentist and they told me I needed a deep scaling cleaning and it was going to take 2 days to accomplish and it was going to cost $1,100. He's thinking about his kid's dentist bills.
Oh.
That's what he's thinking about. Yeah. That's all he's thinking about. Yeah.
I think the bigger question is, how did this movie get to the big screen? And not, like, directly to, you know, the Asylum DVD and sci-fi.
Well, as the person who, I mean, you know, a lot of the movies I review for the LA Times are not the ones that the staff, you know, critics review. The big movies, big Hollywood movies, the big prestige movies. So they're all, you know, they're indies, they're foreign genre movies. I review a lot of Bollywood stuff. It's, you know, in some of these movies I'm watching it and I go like, how did this? Well, you know, it's basically, you know, it's probably maybe part of a deal for VOD where, like, you know,
it has to open somewhere
in a theater so that they can say later, opened in Los Angeles, opened in New York.
Because this is only showing like in the burbs, right?
Yes. However, as opposed to
show times in theaters for people.
As opposed to Haunting in Connecticut 2: Ghosts of Georgia, which opened on approximately 3 screens nationwide, this is opening wider. Hmm. Like, this is opening in about 10 Southern California theaters, and I assume other theaters in the country. The press release I got sent in the mail listed all the Southern California theaters that it was opening in. None of them here in the city proper. But, you know, Ontario and Long Beach, you know, Burbank.
Who goes? Like, who? Do
Phil?
Well, Phil goes to everything. Phil goes to everything. That doesn't count. But, like, Phil Blankenship, who he programs the Heavy Hitters Midnights at CineFamily, goes to everything.
So does Dan Waters.
And that's true. Dan Waters also. And the great thing about Phil is that
Dan Waters is going to spiders. So.
The great thing about Phil going to everything is that he will occasionally
then he fails.
He will occasionally uncover a nugget like Standing Ovation,
right?
Which the world needs to know about. Yeah. But I just think, like, because you know, I mean, they're getting a theatrical opening, but you know, no money is being spent on advertising or marketing.
It is literally for the purpose of being able to say for the DVD release or the VOD release
that it had a theatrical release. So, I mean, is there audience strictly either like super hardcore genre people who seek out any movie that's remotely horror-ish?
Yeah.
Or is it and then people who just walk into the theater not knowing what they're going to see and go, oh, spiders. Okay.
Well, no, I understand who goes to see spiders. It's other little indie movies that I review that are maybe like that are just really awful, you know,
relationship
four-walled relationship indie movies that are just wretched or you know that you just kind of wonder really like it, will a single person be paying to see that movie in the week that it shows at that theater?
Yeah,
but Spiders, yeah, I mean, like, you know, there's probably a whole network of people going, gotta go, Spiders this weekend. Yeah. This is the weekend Spiders is
from the Mansquito guy.
It's from
right
there. You go. I mean, that right
I
there.
I got more feedback. I got more feedback on Twitter about this movie than just about anything in the past few weeks, mostly because I included the word Mansquito. In my tweet. And people are like, I love Mansquito. And
this movie has a pedigree.
So how is it?
It's no Mansquito. But there are some really great Everyone who isn't Krista Campbell or Patrick Muldoon is Bulgarian and okay. doing American accents. And so everything sounds like this. This is an evacuation zone. We are under martial law. Get in the truck.
Yeah. I had reviewed a movie last year that was like that. It was with Donald Sutherland and Christian Slater. They were the two like gets that this person got to make a movie. It was like literally it was like a homemade movie except for these two people being in it. It was shot in Bulgaria and it completely had that vibe.
Well, right. You know, that makes the perfect segue to the movie that I saw last night, Miami Connection. Which
I have not seen yet.
Which is it's the new like
sounds like a reality TV series.
So terrible, you got to see it. Kind of outsider art movie. As Hadrian at CineFamily in introducing it last night pointed out that it is an ESL movie. Almost all the cast is American, but they talk like they were being directed by someone who didn't speak English, and so they wind up speaking in a way that sounds like they don't know what they're doing.
That's always like when you see certain Hong Kong movies and the one British or American actor is British or American doesn't talk like they're British or American. They still talk stiltedly.
And what's great is like they do a lot of cursing in ESL. Like there's this one guy who all he does is in every scene is call everybody an SOB. But you know the spelled out version.
As a former ESL teacher, this really, really excites me.
Yeah. So I will see this again with you. You really need to see
English
it.
As a second language. In case anybody doesn't know what ESL
is. It is. This is the product of a Korean born entrepreneur named YK Kim, who apparently came to this country with nothing and became a very successful motivational speaker and Taekwondo instructor and martial arts entrepreneur. And so this was his big movie that he was going to make, and he co-produced it and co-wrote it and stars in it. And it's basically about these orphans who have a rock band, and they're all Taekwondo black belts. And one of the guys in the band falls in love with this girl who's also an orphan, but her brother is a gangster guy who is doing some sort of cocaine dealings with a group of ninjas.
I'm sorry, I fell asleep a little bit.
I don't think I could say that again. So you get several musical numbers of this band singing songs about Taekwondo and about friendship. And then you've got ninjas and bikers and all kinds of stuff. But some of the most
sounds like he's trying to entertain you. I mean, it sounds like there's a valiant effort to entertain.
But it's just one of those things where just there's something wrong in every scene, and just the all the acting is weird. And like there's a moment where you know the five guys who are in the band drive around in this white convertible all the time, and so at one point they're driving away from the club where they perform, and the big mob of ninjas sort of block them in the street, and YK Kim says, "Oh. Ninjas." I can't wait.
Spiders.
Was this a one-off or are they?
They've shown it before and they will show it again. Okay. A Draft House picked it up for release.
I knew they'd shown it once before. Yeah.
We're fast reaching the point where there you could probably have a repertory cinema in the city that only shows like terrible movies.
Well,
with an audience like
that. They had a trailer for one they're showing this weekend that looks pretty amazing, made by a local trial lawyer. Who wrote, directed, stars in, gave himself some love scenes with some pneumatically enhanced actresses. And it's called Get Even, but the way they do the kerning on the title card in the trailer, it looks like Get-Even.
Get-Even.
I'm going to have to try and see that one too. So anyway, Miami Connection is making its way around the country. If it gets anywhere near you, go see it. It has earned its hype.
I love you recommending that and not Identity Thief.
I was never bored in Miami Connection. I was bored a lot in Identity Thief. Like Identity Thief is the kind of movie where you think, oh, they're only in St. Louis? Like how long is this going to take? Oh, that was agony for me, that movie. Okay, so we did not get any emails this week. Not even like emails from Twitter, nothing.
That's correct.
Well, everyone's so upset about the movie that you recommended that wasn't available.
Everybody's mad at me now.
And apparently, it was pointed out on Twitter that one of the lists we read last week was a list we'd already read.
I made more mistakes.
So anyway, please drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
I do have a few in the inbox that I'll get to them next week.
Okay.
So my DVD recommendation for this week.
Yes.
It is available.
Good.
It is not a good movie really, but I find it really entertaining. It's another French movie. It's called Don't Let Me Die on a Sunday.
Isn't there necrophilia in this movie?
That's right.
You were just setting up Alonzo for that, right?
Jean-Marc Barr plays a morgue employee who resuscitates a young, attractive female corpse with his wiener. and then the two of them...
Wait, and I can't curse in this...
Go off... The two of them go off on a jaunt through the Parisian underground of drugs and orgies in S&M environments. There is nothing really...
You are like yelling into the microphone.
Am I yelling into the microphone? Yes. I'm sorry.
Well, he's excited. Because,
apparently.
Because of necrophilia. Because
of wieners.
So this is like, basically, this is like Weekend at Celine's or something like that.
Yeah.
If only he had met Molly Parker's character from Kissed.
Oh, I'm pulling back from the mic. I'm sorry. Okay. That's why I rely on you to tell me my levels to make me pull back from the mic. It's Elodie Boucher.
Oh,
yeah. From Dreamlike of Angels. She's the girl who dies and gets
revived,
loved back into existence together. And it's really
healing power of love.
The whole thing is about...
So basically, if you're a Pushing Daisies fan, you're saying.
Yeah. The whole thing is just about, people of the 90s in Paris being bored and, decadent and terrible. And it's, like I said, it's not a good movie. It's just really fun to watch. There you go.
Right.
The end.
Well, so last week we mentioned Real Genius in passing, and then this week all the news has been about the drone strikes and the white paper and about, killing of civilians from a remote location and the ethics of the government being able to, kill potential terrorists even though not part of a declared war. And so I thought my DVD recommendation this week is Real Genius, which is about that very thing. So there. Robert, what do you got?
If anybody feels like they have been Lincoln'd out already because of not just Lincoln, but you have this TV movie Killing Lincoln based on the Bill O'Reilly book, and you have this movie called Saving Lincoln. I mean, there's like
a National Geographic.
It did make me think about the Warner Archive, which is the where you can
movies
say I want to. This DVD, and they make it for you, and they send it right here.
French Jean-Marc Barr would try to bring him back to life after the assassination.
through the Warner Archive, you can get this really great kind of unsung movie from the early 50s that Anthony Mann made called The Tall Target, which was actually about a real life attempt on Lincoln's life before he was assassinated, and it was going to take place on a train. And Dick Powell plays I believe he's a Pinkerton agent. I believe I could be a little wrong about that, but he is tasked with trying to figure out who on this train is going to try and kill Lincoln. And it's like a noir movie, but set in the 1860s.
The narrow margin of a Western.
Right, basically, yeah. And it's an incredibly exciting, really short, tight train suspense movie. And it's got some amazing stuff in it. Dick Powell, who ended up being this great noir actor.
Yeah.
I mean, no one ever talks about this performance, because he did all this great detective movies.
Farewell, My Lovely.
He's fantastic in this. It just got tons of atmosphere, really exciting and suspenseful. And Anthony Mann, making kind of like a movie that, you know, isn't a, really a Western, but is a little bit, and it's, yeah, it's fantastic.
Cool. All right. I do not know that one. I will.
The Tall Target.
The Tall Target. I will look for it. Yeah, no, I'm a very big fan of this whole MOD thing, because I think there's a lot.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
There's a lot of back catalog titles that are never going to be marketable enough to, you know, sell at Walmart, but there's going to be.
But there's some people out there who are willing to spend, you know, a little bit more, maybe $20 for whatever to have their own copy of, you know.
Now I have my copy of The Finks, so, you know.
It was a very exciting day for him when that showed up. Recently, he learned that At Long Last Love is going to come out on Blu-ray.
Yes!
Blu-ray. That's going to be another very exciting day for Alonso Duralde.
And it's actually, you know, speaking of Peter Bogdanovich, I was just reading that...
Yeah, he's going to get to make a movie
he's
now.
He's doing a movie with Jennifer Aniston and Owen Wilson, and it's being executive produced by Noah Baumbach and Wes Anderson.
Oh.
And, you know, it occurred to me that, you know, like Spielberg took some heat for the fact that he was willing to spend millions on the surviving Rosebud sled, but would not help Orson Welles get a last movie made. You know, when Welles was still alive and it was later in his career, nobody wanted to deal with him. You had people like Spielberg and Coppola and like the Young Turks who adored him, but not enough to actually give him any backing. So I think the fact that Anderson and Baumbach are willing to like exercise their clout on behalf of Peter Bogdanovich to let him get another movie made is pretty awesome.
Yeah, now he just has to make a good movie.
Well, yeah, but you know what? We loved Noises Off. Don't forget. Yeah,
but, you know, that's because I love Noises Off.
Well, I came in cold. I'd never seen the play. And he could have messed that up, you must admit.
But that's like a clinical piece of direction. It's like basically you have to just like show these things happening.
He was a traffic cop,
you've done
it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, what's the last thing he did? The Thing Called Love? Or
the last movie he directed?
Yeah.
No, he directed Cat's Meow with Kirsten Dunst.
Yes, which I didn't
see. Which, you know, it's not that bad.
And Joanna Lumley's in that, right?
Yeah.
Didn't she like the woman who wrote It or whatever?
There's something else too. I'm forgetting something else.
And probably some TV stuff.
Yeah.
He's had an erratic career, but I think he has made some, at least a handful of genuinely great movies. He's certainly as a student of the cinema, you know, he is unparalleled. And so I don't know. I want people like him to still get the chance to work.
Yeah, my wife Margie wrote a great piece for the LA Weekly years ago, where they drove around LA, and he kind of, you know, pointed out, you know, key spots in his life. Mm-hmm. And
I had my driving around Polly Platt story once, which was, you know, I was kind of pumping her for some dirt. So she was very nice, and, you know, she told me things about the making of I'll Do Anything. look, anybody who directed What's Up, Doc? And is still alive, let him keep directing, because he might make another one. You never
Correct.
Know. All right. I guess that is it for this week. Thank you for joining us. Robert Abley, where can people find you?
Where can people find me?
Yeah.
Do I have to give out my home address?
Social Security number.
It's time for you to build your brand.
Let's see. Well,
you don't tweet, do you?
My reviews. No, I don't tweet. I keep
very disappointing.
Do you friend people? Do you friend strangers on Facebook, or do you have that locked in?
No, I've done that, absolutely.
Okay. Well, so he is Robert Abley, Abele, on Facebook, where he'll be posting links to all of his stuff.
Yeah, typically. My reviews appear in the LA Times on Friday, or if they're not shown in advance for critics, which they sometimes aren't, on other days. And
you can buy his book.
And I also have a piece in the DGA Quarterly magazine, which is available online, about House of Cards, the Netflix series.
Now, do you watch the whole thing?
No, when I did the piece, I got to see the first two episodes. But I talked to all the directors who directed all the episodes, including Fincher, and it was fun.
Nice. And Robert's book on the Twilight series of films is available at Amazon and wherever fine books are sold. We'll post a link to it on the Linoleum Knife page, which we ask you to like if you have not already. Thank you for doing the show.
Oh, no, thank you guys.
We, as always, remind you to check out our friends in the podcast universe, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys at the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Podcrash, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this program on iTunes, and if you would leave us a positive review there, we'd appreciate it. It helps more people find the show.
Yes.
You can stream us at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com. You can follow the show at Twitter, at LinoleumCast. You can follow me at A. Duraldi, A-D-U-R-A-L-D-E. And you can follow Dave at D. Leland White. You can check into the show at getglue.com. And again, our email address is linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We do love hearing from you. We're going to be catching up on mail, and we're not going to read any more lists twice.
Show these guys some love.
Goodbye.